Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 17th, 2019, and welcome to episode 190 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and innovations. I'm hosting today. I'm Earl Evans, coming to you not live, but alive in Portland, Oregon. I'm joined by some of our awesome regulars. First off, we'll go over to Boston, Mass, and see how Paul Hagstrom is doing.
Let's see. He's doing fine.
That's excellent.
The spring has begun to arrive, and I work at a university, so there's a spring break which has just ended. So, I mean, I was probably doing finer a week ago, but at any rate, all is well.
Excellent. Now we'll ricochet over to Stockholm, Sweden, and notice my specificity in that, Jack. I didn't just say Sweden or, you know, east somewhere.
That's very good.
Yeah, thank you. I do listen to the RCRs that I'm not on. So how are you, Jack?
Yeah, I'm doing well. I've been having a pretty lazy weekend here. I've wanted to go outside and take some walks and stuff, but it's been kind of drizzly and cold and miserable the whole time. So it's like Sweden has these periods where it just like hovers around freezing for months on end, and like it's never like cold enough for snow to stick, at least in Stockholm. The snow doesn't stick around, and you just kind of have this kind of like depressing rain all day long most of the time. So that's not fun, but apart from that, I'm doing pretty well.
I guess that's an excuse to stay in and play with technology, maybe?
That's been my excuse today, so.
Awesome. Well, I don't have that excuse, although I might go ahead and stay inside anyway, but I'm looking out at some pretty nice weather here in Portland. It looks like maybe spring has come a little early, which is kind of good because in the first week of March, we were still having snow, and I'm going to tell you that's exceptionally weird for Portland in the first week of March. In fact, in 25 years here, I don't know that I've ever seen that. So I'm happy to see blue skies and temperatures creeping into the 50s and maybe even, the lower 60s. So, yay!
That's nice. I remember there was one year when we actually had a huge, huge blizzard in Boston on April 1st. And that was what was particularly cool about that was that at the time I was a resident assistant in a dorm. And so I had to convince everybody that school was canceled. but of course, you know, no, the people's first reaction was not to believe me.
Right. Oh, sure. Oh, my. Well, hey, we might as well talk about technology. And I had a thought today to talk about things that were super innovative for the time in which they were invented or at least talked about. You know, as I look back at the 60s, 70s, 80s time periods that we tend to cover on the show, I thought, what technology would you say, or kind of combination of technologies or concepts you thought were the most innovative, the most forward-looking? And that can be something that's still in use today, or maybe something that never quite made it, but you thought was really an interesting take on things. So I'm going to go around the table here. Paul, if it's okay, we'll start with you, and maybe you can, you know, clue us in on something from the old days that you think was really such a super bright idea.
Well, okay, so I have to say that when you proposed this idea, you then laid claim to the thing that was like the most innovative, forward-looking thing that covers everything.
Well, yeah, of course.
So,
I mean, it was my idea. I had to steal the best example.
Right. Yeah, so I was sort of looking at that and thinking, well, geez, I don't know what else to say. So, in fact, I might suggest that we start with yours, because mine just pales in comparison.
Sure, we can. In fact, if you want, we can all just talk about this one.
Yeah.
Because you're right. So much about this, and by the way, the listeners don't know what we're talking about yet, but might have guessed that in the 60s, Doug Engelbart and his team presented something that later was labeled the mother of all demos. It turns out that in 62, Engelbart had submitted a report called Augmenting Human Intellect, a Conceptual Framework, by Douglas C. Engelbart, October of 1962. And I just want to mention in passing, a lot was going on in October of 1962. First off, I was in the process of being born, which, you know, I'm kind of happy about. And secondly, I was born right dead center in the Cuban Missile Crisis, an international conflict that almost led us to the brink of nuclear war. These were really interesting times. You know the saying, may you live in interesting times? So you got to think, you know, lots going on, and obviously it just the 60s worldwide, such a tumultuous and rich period for new thoughts. So anyway, Engelbart submitted that, and by the way, Engelbart, born in Portland, Oregon. Just want to throw that in as well.
But somewhat earlier than you.
Earlier than me, yes, because otherwise I don't think he'd have been able to write this and submit it in 62. So I think that the first sentence in this report that he submitted is really interesting. He says, by augmenting human intellect, we mean increasing the capability of a man to approach a complex problem situation, to gain comprehension to suit his particular needs, and to derive solutions to problems. So that was 1962. So by the time 1968 rolled around, they had developed this technology called, I believe, the Online System, or the NLS. They demoed it, and it included all kinds of technologies and concepts that we wouldn't see until years later, some decades later, in common use. For instance, Windows and hypertext, a graphical interface, and a pointing device that they called the mouse. This demo also included some remote collaboration between one site and another site interactively working on a document. And so, like you said, Paul, this was just amazing, and took, you know, obviously a lot of processing power for the time. Later, we'd be able to wrap all this up into something that would fit in your hand, but so forward-looking that it took practically forever for some of this to come out. If I understand it correctly, some of these technologies then made it to Xerox PARC, where, of course, you know, famously, Steve Jobs and his team saw them, translated them into what would become the Lisa, then the Macintosh. Microsoft also obviously had their take on this. Windows, you guys might have heard of that. But that was, you know, if I'm remembering right, it was mid-80s before some of this stuff was debuting in a quasi-usable state, and it wasn't until the early 90s when this stuff actually started to get powerful enough and cheap enough where you could have it in small businesses or in the home. So that's a long way from 1968. So I'm going to say this is one of the most innovative things in the history of ever. And I think that we've talked about it, too, on the show before, so I won't belabor it any further, except that I will throw out one comment that is a, you know, quasi-social commentary, so please forgive me on this. But Engelbart's goal, per that first sentence in his report that he submitted, was to use these technologies to augment human intelligence. Now, I look at where we've gone with things like social media and other modern contemporary concepts today, and a lot of the things that I interact with online, I feel like I'm actually dumber after I've interacted with them than before I started. And so I've wondered now for like a decade since I read What the Dormouse Said, which was a book about this whole incubation period of all this stuff in the 60s, whether or not we really accomplished the goal of augmenting human intelligence. We certainly made some excellent communication technology that everybody is using, but I don't know if we're better problem solvers. So I'll just throw out that hand grenade, you know, lob that into the conversation. And then, you know, Jack, do you have, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, I have to admit shamefully, I've never watched this whole thing. I've seen bits of it for a number of years. And I think what's interesting, I think, about that is that I first ever heard of this Mother All Demos maybe 10 years ago, not more than that, certainly. So, and people talk about it, you know, we have talked about it on the show before, and now and then I hear it mentioned at work or something, someone will mention it. And it's interesting that it was kind of under the radar, seemingly, for a long time. And maybe it's, you know, there wasn't really a handy thing like YouTube more than a dozen years ago. So maybe that's part of why it wasn't that easy to spread things around. People were, you know, I never happened to have a copy of a videotape of this thrown my way. But
right.
But like compared to other, you know, so in my computer science education, we talked about things that happened in the 60s in terms of development, software development technologies and computer science, you know, theoretical underpinnings that were developed. But this was never mentioned. I imagine some of my professors may have been aware of this or seen it, but it was not anything that was talked about in curriculum or anything. Even though, as you say, it was technology that was way ahead of, or a demo of something that was way ahead of what was commercially going to be viable at the time in terms of what could be, you know, processing power was too limited, all that. So I don't know. I think it's, I keep meaning to go back to it. I've watched clips now and then. And every time I think of it, it's like, oh, right, I got to remember to watch this, and then I just don't. Because it's pretty long, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is pretty long. And, I'm going to say, frankly, parts of it are a little bit boring when you're going through it. It takes some stamina to get through the whole thing.
Sure.
I have watched the whole thing. I mean, it's kind of a combination of, wow, this is black and white and just a dude talking. You know, so it's like you got to power through it. But on the other hand, you realize the sheer magnitude of what you're watching. You know,
right.
This is where all of this stuff started. So kind of a, you know, like eat your vegetables. They're good for you.
Yeah. Well, one thing that's interesting about this also, I was noticing today we got, we were sent by a reader. Or not a reader, a listener. He probably reads too. But I mean, a listener to the podcast named Ray. He sent us a slideshow of this Apple Lisa promo called the Lisa Flash Multi-Image Show, which is apparently someone digitized this off of VCS. And it is, or VHS. And it is it's a slideshow presented to Lisa with like, it's pretty crazy. It's got like this nice voiceover and like songs. You know, there's like a weird theme song now and then. There's like a little chorus singing Lisa.
What was this for? In what context was this made?
This was a promo thing for the Lisa when it was new, and like where this slideshow went to, I don't know. Like it's obviously not made for television because it's not a video. It's a slideshow, and so when they want to show something in motion, like someone moving a mouse across the table, it's still image. Still image, still image, with a hand on a mouse moving across. Anyway, so I don't really know what the intended audience of this was exactly. It's about 7 minutes long, I think. But what I was thinking about as we were talking is that the Lisa was probably the first chance that most people outside of a lab had a chance to see the kind of things that Engelbart demoed in 1968. This is like took about 15 years before anybody outside of a very specialized group saw a computer mouse and saw things like windows on a screen and using a pointer and that kind of thing. And I thought it was there's an interesting parallel there, just from the, you know, or little coincidence that we got this video, which we will link to in the show notes also. And one other thing that I thought of as we were talking is you mentioned that Engelbart's idea was to improve human intelligence or
augment.
And one of the things that they talk about a little bit in this slideshow for the Lisa, they're talking about the software and that, you know, it's kind of generic. It's saying, well, there's word processing and there's, you know, spreadsheets and graphics and things. But they're talking about this all in terms of how this is going to make work easier for someone who's like a business person, someone working in an office, that it's going to sort of make it easier to do your tasks. And one of the things they mention is that compared to previous software on the Lisa, there are no function keys, there are no commands to remember because it's all point and click, you know, with icons and drop down menus. The same thing that, you know, it's interesting when you look at it today, it looks very much like it's Mac OS is essentially pretty similar. But one thing that struck me about that, because they actually say in there, once you learn how to use one piece of software, you'll know how to use all the pieces of software. In the sense, you'll know how to operate them, how to find things in the menus and all that stuff. And that's something that I think that was always sort of a cornerstone of the Mac experience that nowadays is kind of vanishing in a sense. Or like, if you think of your smartphone, you know, every crazy new app the kids are using, you have to look at it and say, okay, oh, how does this work? Where do I swipe to do what? How do I find the thing? Because it seems today that GUI designers have totally left behind any ideas of trying to have similarity. It's just like, let's design something crazy and fun to use somehow, but it ends up being a discoverability problem.
I know it makes me a geezer, but I'm okay being a geezer in this context. I think with web applications, we actually took a step backward in terms of ease of use. Because if you think about it, every web site that you go to, and they are effectively an application. They're a lot more than that. But as an app, every single website that I go to has a completely different user interface. And you're right. I remember coming from the DOS days where every application that you use Lotus, you use WordPerfect, or another word processor that we used was Multimate. It was similar, I'm told, to the Wang word processor system, which I never actually did use. But if you think about that, DBase, you know, all those things, they had radically different interfaces. And then when Windows came around, you at least had some idea where to go looking for what you were trying to do, right?
Right. Yep.
And
I think that, it's something that somewhat we seem to have lost along the way. And I think you may be right that maybe kind of the era of web design that kind of threw us off that track. And I think that's carried on into mobile UI design where, you know, anybody who's been working as a computer interface designer for more than 10 years, if they're working as a mobile designer now, they probably were working as a web designer before. So most people have come from there into mobile design and think, no, well, we can just make this, you know, however we want. And what I've noticed even more lately is this carries back onto the Mac sometimes. There are a lot of these Electron apps like Slack, say that businesses all over the world use Slack all the time. I'm on Slack every hour that I'm at work, I'm on Slack. Mm-hmm. And as a result of its heritage as a web application, maybe, it has a really pretty confusing interface that, like, it's hard to know, okay, which magic button am I going to click on to find the pop-up menu on this interface that's going to give me the right thing? Because there are at any one time, there are several of them in the window. And they're not necessarily grouped in what seems to me a logical way of like, yeah, here's where I should find stuff about this. It's kind of like, oh, it's just going to be somewhere. And some of these things might have corresponding things in the top level menu, and some of them don't. And you just, it's just a lot of trial and error. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I feel like, and if you want to get back to augmenting human intelligence, we need to be able to get back to building things that work in a consistent way with each other so that the interface gets out of the way.
That's a very, very thoughtful statement. And I think the ultimate would be a way for application designers to express their creativity and uniqueness without completely throwing out any kind of uniformity of design or interface. You know, there's got to be a happy medium somewhere.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you were talking, I was reminded of Skype. You know, for a long time, every time we recorded, there was a new update to Skype that made it incrementally worse. but one of the things that I just can't stand about it is that, you know, in that sense of, you know, the interface getting out of the way, we want that sort of consciously to happen. We don't want the actual buttons to disappear, you know? Because, like, you don't know what, like, the only way you can find a button is to wave the cursor around. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, all right, there's a button there.
My statement that I use at work is, don't move my cheese. You know, when I've figured out where my cheese is, you know, I've made it all the way through the maze, don't start moving my cheese, because you're messing with me. So, Paul, what are your thoughts on this mother of all demos? And then I think we should talk about your candidate here for innovative, forward-looking sort of technology.
Sure, yeah. So I also, you know, I will admit that I too have not actually made it all the way through the mother of all demos, but I did get a lot further through it today than I have before. You know, I made it, you know, I skipped around a bit, but one of the things that sort of struck me about it is that I could see maybe why this wouldn't have made it into the, you know, fundamentals of computing classes and things like that in a way, just because, like, it in and of itself doesn't really seem like much of anything until we get to now and we look back and we say, oh, geez, all that stuff we do use now all the time was there. But you know, like, you know, it's just sort of like demonstrating a way that, you know, like their system works. And, you know, you can tell that they put a lot of thought into it. And it's interesting how all that stuff is really familiar. You know, like, this is sort of like an outliner. You can collapse stuff. You can, you know, you can use these, you know, combinations of typing and the mouse and stuff. And, you know, clicking through links and all that stuff. You know, it's quite possible that if you're not really receptive to it, like if you're not ready to use it, it doesn't have any impact on you. So,
You know, that brings up a thought that one thing that I have never seen is news coverage or follow-on reports of this demo. I mean, everybody. At least in the computer history kind of, you know, enthusiast realm that we chat with has probably heard of this, but I wonder what people thought about it at the time. Mm-hmm. I wonder if they were wowed by it or if they just walked away going, well, you know, that's an hour in my life I can't get back. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see if there were any follow-on write-ups or stuff like this. I might try to track that down.
Yeah, it would be interesting to, and it's possible, I guess it is possible that people did realize, you know, those who saw it realized this is not something that we can really implement in any real way, but it's just amazing. I mean, you know, it was essentially an entirely graphical interface in that, you know, like everything could be resized, all the, you know, it could have little text and big text, you know, all the sort of like clicking and moving and copying and pasting and everything was, you know, all. He was just sort of demonstrating it as, and of course they were using it in their offices for a long time before this demo. So they'd sort of worked out, you know, what works and what doesn't. One thing that I think is kind of interesting that did not make it is the little 5-key keyboard.
The cord. Yeah. That just kind of vanished and never made it into the mainstream, right?
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, and he talked a little bit about that, about there's, you know, there's 5 keys, which gives you 31 things you can do with it. And he was actually typing with it. I mean, you know, like he had managed to internalize, you know, how you type with it. So that he could actually, you know, make text. It was just wild. And I kind of like that. I think it would be pretty cool to be able to do that. You'd think it could be fast.
Well, I've wondered why we limit ourselves to one physical finger digit at a time when we're typing. And, you know, basically our thumbs are taken up by the space bar. So we basically got 8 different choices of fingers to press and only one at a time. Whereas when you do things like, for instance, play the guitar or play the piano or something like that, you're using all of them at the same time in kind of a fluid motion. And why wouldn't the cord be a more effective human-computer interface? I don't know. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but it didn't go anywhere. I mean, I have something from Belkin, actually, with a brand name, maybe not a brand name, like a line of products that they called Nostromo for gaming. There's a gamepad, and there was also this left-hand device with some keys and a little arrow that you could hit with your thumb that reminded me a lot of the cord. And even that device didn't seem to really take off in the gaming community either. It's more like people go for the WASD interface when they're doing online gaming and not something like this left-hand cord device. Not sure why.
Yeah, I think I've seen these too. I remember a long time ago thinking about buying one, but I never did. But it seems like, I think it works like a keyboard, so you can map it to your WASD keys and all that. But then at the end of the day, I think a lot of time you end up opening a lot of gaming these days, people are playing online, and sometimes they're going to type something at their teammates, and so then you have to move your hand away from it, I guess. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I guess if people think that, well, I have to have a whole keyboard anyway for my PC gaming, so why do I want a half keyboard also next to it? Although I think that ergonomically it'd be kind of nice. The way you already have your right hand out holding a mouse, you have your left hand out resting on this little half keyboard. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've thought of that too. Those could have an interesting use beyond just games, maybe, but someone would have to do some work for it.
And if you somehow had some kind of thing that was effectively a full keyboard that you didn't have to move your fingers around for, you know, like just at least what I mean is no travel, right? Then, right. You could be typing while walking around, you know, yep. Getting run over by buses and stuff.
It'd be worse than texting.
Yeah.
Well, actually, this reminds me of something else when we're talking about this. I encountered this a couple of years ago, and I keep thinking about it now and then I forget about it. iOS has had, since iOS 8, a built-in Braille input mode. So if you are blind, you can take your phone, flip it upside down, hold it horizontally in like landscape mode, hold it upside down so your fingers are on the screen, and you... cording, enter letters just like you would on a Braille input device, which is also a corded device. So use both hands to type at once, one character at a time.
That is fascinating, really.
Yes, and I've been meaning to sort of actually try it sometime, and it's built into iOS, so anybody can do it. And it is actually, you know, just like we were saying, it's not one-handed. It is a two-handed thing, but it is also a corded thing, because in Braille you have these little 6 dots per character, and so you use 3 fingers in each hand to type one character at a time, just by touching your fingers on it.
Wow, that is awesome!
I'd never known that. I'll have to check that out.
I'm sure I'll try and find something we can put a link in the show notes to. It's a whole thing.
Well, any other thoughts on this one before we move on to Paul's other one?
It's definitely worth watching. It is, YouTube does give you the possibility to watch it at 1.75 speed, so that's probably good enough. But that's why I can attest to the fact that it is still comprehensible at that speed. I have tried it.
Nice.
But yeah, so the when I was, you know, sort of fishing around to try to find, you know, like what kind of thing could have that kind of impact. I don't know that I really want to make the claim that this did, but I thought this was kind of an interesting thing, which is the IXO telecomputing system. So that is, I think we may have talked about it a little bit before, but it's basically a little terminal that, you know, it's basically a little keyboard and a one line little liquid crystal display that you plug directly into your telephone, and you know, it's just a terminal, you know, so you can get a hold of like TimeNet or whatever. There's a write-up in the April 1982 Byte magazine. It's the cover photo, and there's an editorial about it where it's just sort of like, you know, it says, imagine a terminal that costs about $500 and can access, you know, the source and Dow Jones and CompuServe and have a full ASCII character set, have a built-in modem, be able to emulate terminals, operate from a battery. And it's basically just, you know, the idea is it's a little portable messaging system, portable terminal system. And what's kind of, so there's a couple of interesting things about it. One is that in developing this, they developed the IXO TAP protocol, which is basically the protocol that is behind all of pager, all the alphanumeric pagers. I mean, like this has lasted to the current day, you know. I mean, I guess alphanumeric pagers barely exist anymore, but to the extent that they exist, that protocol still exists for it. And it was so that's, you know, that's one thing that this little device, even though I don't think it really took off that much, I mean, like it was on the cover of Byte, but then, you know, but it you know, really was sort of an early kind of portable messaging device. And they're pretty cool. And the other thing that is kind of interesting about it is that it is a follow-on project by the people who created Merlin, the little game.
Oh, interesting.
So, after having massive success with Mattel, right, I think, and Merlin, you know, they went on, Bob and Holly Doyle went on to make the IXO telecomputer. And the Byte write-up is actually pretty interesting.
Cool.
Very interesting.
Another link, I don't know if it's even worth putting this here, but whether we link to it or not, in 2014, I stated that I was going to enter the retro challenge because I have a couple of these. I have one of the things that's possible with these little telecomputers is that they have this like array of possible peripherals that you could get. They are exceedingly rare. I happen to have, I think, a nearly complete set, but it was not trivial. And, you know, so there's a little printer and there's a little actual, like, phone coupler, and there's a, like, a video interface and stuff. And it little fits in a little suitcase, you know, for your portable traveling. But, so I had this project that I was going to try to figure out how to deal with it, because, of course, the way it worked, the way you sort of set it up is you sign into TimeNet, you know, and do some sort of communication that lets you set passwords and things like that on your machine. But of course, there's nobody on the other end anymore.
Right.
So I had as a project to kind of go through, scan all the things, and, you know, try to figure out how to make them communicate with stuff. And so I have a pretty elaborate first entry, and that's where it stops. But it was, I still, you know, like, despite the fact that it is 5 years later now, I still want to do this.
Right.
Sure. Well, these kind of projects, they can linger for a while. You know, it's nothing wrong with that. You swing back around to it sometime.
Yeah. But part of the reason that I'm not, I'll probably link to it, but I feel sort of bad linking to it because it's on my blog and all the links are dead. So, I have to fix all these links, particularly all the scans, because I scanned everything and put them on Dropbox, you know, public shared folders, because I thought, you know, this will always work. And then Dropbox had, you know, disconnected that ability, so now all of the links to all the PDFs go to 404 pages, because, you know, they're still in my Dropbox, but the links don't work anymore.
So. I didn't know Dropbox had done that. You can't link out to a specific document on there like you can with Google Drive or whatever?
Well, you can, but it used to be actually a little bit more hierarchical. So you sort of like, you link to something in your public shared folder and you could sort of see the whole path name and, you know, you could just change the URL and get the new one. Now there's this sort of like random token. So everything is a direct individual link and you can't see the folders it's in. And, you know, so I have to reformat all, I have to like regenerate all my links.
Gotcha.
Or Fine. Really what I should do is put them on archive.org.
That'll work too. Yeah. Well, I'm going to throw out a couple of other things real quick, and I guess we won't spend the time to talk about them unless you guys feel real strongly about it, because I think they've both of them have already been talked about extensively on the show in the past. But in terms of a couple of other technologies that I thought of that were really ahead of their time, one was the Plato educational system. Mm-hmm. You know, the online system for learning that has recently been kind of reinvigorated with Errata Online and with terminal programs for it being created for a variety of retro computers, you know, that you can connect to. Is really cool. That project is awesome. And the other one was the French Minitel system that, you know, late 70s, early 80s, they had a terminal system in the home for kind of mass communications. And I think they were way ahead of the curve on that one.
Yep, I remember hearing about that in the 80s. And then when I was a student and I went to France in spring of 1990, I was kind of keeping an eye out for this because I had heard about it. And I remember seeing it like in a hotel, like in the lobby. There was one kind of behind a desk somewhere in, I guess, an old French version of their business center. But like the host family I was staying with did not have one. And I couldn't really get a grip of how common it was. I remember asking someone and they kind of like, yeah, it's a thing we have. I don't know. They kind of took it for granted and didn't seem to think much of it, that it was this, you know, networking thing that you could connect other people and stuff. It's kind of like, yeah, I don't know. It's a thing.
Well, maybe like with a lot of things, maybe too far ahead of its time. Maybe people weren't kind of grasping it yet. All right, well, we'll move on from innovations to recreations. I guess we can... actually, before we get to the items of interest and news, though, we've got listener feedback. We should do some of that because we love our listeners.
We do.
Don't we, Paul? I think
we should. Yeah, we sure do. I was not laughing derisively.
Yeah, we love our listeners, sure.
We love our listeners and our readers.
That's right.
So, Paul, what have we got in listener feedback? Who's talking to us?
Well, so there's a number of people have written a number of things, but I will read a number of things. So, Eric, we were talking, I think, last time about sort of like updates to old system software and, you know, like modern updates to things. And Eric wrote to talk about Amiga OS. You know, I think I knew some of these points, but so there were lots of Amiga users in Europe, and it was then they're a particularly stubborn bunch who just refused to accept the death of the platform. But things get sort of complicated because, of course, Commodore went away, and there are rights, and
the rights got ricocheted all over the anyway.
Right.
Don't get me started on that. I very much sympathize with our listener reader on that one.
Right. Yeah. So you know, it becomes sort of unclear what the status of this is. But and apparently, essentially, nobody who's working on Amiga OS is working from source. That it's all, you know, patching original Commodore binaries of some sort, or at least that's what Eric thinks. But so there's Amiga OS 4.x, which is an all new modern branch for Power PC systems, and whose latest revision came out in 2014. But then Amiga 3.x for the original 68K machines is also still being worked on, I think in a separate, you know, separate endeavor, received a new update in 2018. So the recent release of Amiga OS 3.14 by Hyperion Entertainment are also responsible for OS 4.x, and so these are worth looking at if you are interested in Amiga OS. Eric says this is worth talking about, but I know only what he has written. Maybe actually, Earl, have you, or both of you, have Amiga experience that I lack?
Yeah, I do, but mine kind of ended in the 90s, so I don't really know. I haven't followed much what has happened since. I like to see tidbits now and then, but I learned a lot from Eric's email that I did not know.
Mm-hmm. So I've taken a look at a lot of these modern day efforts, and I have to say they're very impressive. And it's not just software. I mean, you can actually still buy some hardware to run these things on, believe it or not. But the question then becomes price, performance, and what are you really getting? You know, how much do you have to be invested in the Amiga world to purchase this and actually still hang on to it? And it's a little beyond what I'm able to either afford or invest, I guess partially because after the 8-bit Commodores, I kind of lost track of Commodore. It was really hard to even find a store that had the Amiga, even in Computer Row, where I lived at the time. So had it been the case that I got an Amiga and really loved it and stuff like that, I might have been one of the diehards that wanted to stick with the platform. But I will say I've taken a look at, looked at videos, looked at some of the end products, and it's really very cool what they're still doing out there.
Yeah, that's a world that I someday want to look into a little bit more. But anyway, so he sort of finishes off saying Amiga OS 3.14 is actually newer than Amiga OS 3.5 and 3.9, which were released in 1999 and 2000 respectively. All of them were based on 3.1. I think 3.5 and 3.9 were released by a different company, Haga and Partner, it looks like. And so anyway, yeah, I guess what this means is there's a lot of activity in the Amiga domain.
That new one runs on some of the older hardware, right? The 68000 series. Did you say that? I think that one that's newer than the others that you were talking about, I think part of the reasoning for that numbering is it still runs on some of the older 68K Amigas.
Right. Yes. 3.14. According to Eric, 3.14 had a quite a warm welcome in the Amiga community and is a nice update for even a stock 68000 Amiga, whereas 3.5 and 3.9 can feel unnecessarily bloated on slower systems. Anyway, yes. Interesting stuff. Thanks, Eric, for sending that. Let's see. Martin wrote on Twitter, just pointing out, maybe now two or three times ago, we talked about teaching kids with retro computers. And so Martin pointed out, let's see, I have a tab somewhere that has this in it, I think. But anyway, it's the Kano computer, which is basically a platform based on a Raspberry Pi. And it's designed basically so that, you know, you don't really, the Raspberry Pi-ness of it is not crucial. You know, you can, a kid can assemble it by sticking little pieces together with the Raspberry Pi and plugging stuff together. And there's a couple of different kits you can get. One of the sort of simplest ones is a wand that is like it's sort of Harry Potter themed, and you build this little wand that can sense motion in various directions. And then on a computer or a tablet, you can program what happens if you move it up or move it left or whatever. There's little triggers and actions, and you can cause it to make things on the screen change color and stuff like that. And so it's supposed to be kind of a simple teaching kids simple programming tool that also lets you see like the underlying JavaScript that it generates and things like that. So it's relatively sophisticated, not super cheap, but built on the Raspberry Pi. But it isn't just setting a kid loose in Linux, you know? So on Facebook, Ted wondered, so last time one of the eBay auctions was this Portabubble 81, which, you know, I just thought it had a delightful name and looked cool and all that stuff. But Ted wondered if the bubble in the name actually was referring to bubble memory, and indeed it is, it turns out. I found a scan of an ad that actually does sort of like promote that as a one of the things about it. The ad itself, the scan is not great, but the ad copy starts off saying, "Bubble Memory, the significant new long retention storage system, is incorporated in Telaram's state-of-the-art Portabubble 81. So that's kind of interesting. It's, you know, resilient memory, and that explains why it seemed like there was a file system on that one that was in the auction. Actually, I don't know if it sold, but at any rate. And then Chris wrote on Facebook, pointed out that I think Quinn had suggested that, you know, like one of the, we were talking about, I think, connecting retro keyboards to your modern computer, and the sort of problem with the fact that you don't have any of your like necessary keys if you do that. Chris had pointed out that there is something called an XK16 stick, which is basically just a stick of keys that you can plug in. I think it's a USB thing, which, you know, you could conceivably use as an augment to, you know, give you the keys that you're missing on your Mac 128 keyboard or, you know, whatever it is you're using.
Wait, how's this work again? What is the... I'm sorry, I see that it is a USB little 16-key amendment to your keyboard, but I'm lost on how you use this. What is this for again?
Well, I think the idea was... So we were talking about the possibility of connecting like an old Mac keyboard to your modern laptop or something.
Oh, I see.
So the problem is it's missing a lot of keys that you'd want.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is just a way to get some extra keys, you know. So,
like maybe it doesn't have function keys or some of the other... Gotcha.
We thought it might be, you know, the new next big retro product, but one kind of exists. Not super cheap, but, you know, not super expensive either. $110, it seems to... Or if you... slightly less if you buy 10. Then you can have whatever it is, 160 keys.
That's more than I have right now.
That's right. I think, yeah, the last bit of feedback I will point out is actually, it's almost like an item of interest and news, but I will say it anyway. So Ben on Facebook pointed to a kind of delightful little article called Pac-Man, The Untold Story of How He Really Played the Game. I think part of what really just captures my interest in this is just the way it starts, which is, you know, it starts with this image of these... you know, worn out stairs where, like, essentially they've just been worn out through, you know, lots, many, many people, you know, going up and down them and for centuries or whatever, you know, and then transitioning to looking at Pac-Man cabinets and how the paint on the, like, left edge is always, like, worn off. And you know, it basically sort of, you know, it talks about this very common wear pattern and essentially sort of discusses, like, what is going on is that basically, everyone who plays Pac-Man, you know, winds up adopting this position where they're sort of grabbing the cabinet on the left, and sort of like the interface design that leads to that, because you have this single joystick in the middle and nothing to balance with it. You know, like, so most other games have, you know, you're using both hands to do something, whereas this, you know, like, all you have is this, like, one, you know, one hand is stuck in the control, and then so you need to put your arm somewhere else. And so there's, you know, all these, like, old photos of, you know, people in 1981 grabbing that spot.
How interesting. Oh, my gosh. Forensic recreation of how people were standing at Pac-Man.
Yep.
Yeah.
Pretty sweet.
There are some pretty hilarious photos, actually, of people, you know, people's stances. Anyway, but and so it's interesting to look at the article, and then there's also he also sort of linked to a Hacker News discussion that was more about kind of like philosophies of restoration, basically. But like, what do you do with a cabinet that has that wear pattern and so forth? But anyway, it's a surprisingly delightful article. So,
well, you obviously leave it, because if you're going to stand and play the game, you're probably just going to wear that area out again anyway.
That's right.
So don't fix it.
Yeah, that wear pattern shows the love of the game.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I remember one time I found a thing that I mentioned in the show when we were talking about eBay stuff. I had found like an Atari Lynx that the corners, the bottom corners were so worn down that like whoever had used this had played it so much that like their hands wore through layers of paint and layers of plastic. And it was like, the whole thing was like, it's like, man, someone must have... I wonder what that person's hands look like. They must have just like squeezed and pushed this thing so long for so many hours that you could like see the love imprint in the device. And kind of the same thing here. Like, you see like people are grabbing that left edge for dear life. And this reminds me of something else. I recently joined a Reddit subgroup that I found that is called Desire Paths. And it's all just people posting photos of paths through grassy areas, through forests, through whatever edges, you know, edges of motorways next to parking lots or whatever, where people just gravitate to walk. Like, regardless of where the sidewalks are placed, people are going to walk in certain ways. And this is the same kind of thing. Like, no one really meant for people to grab that Pac-Man edge all the time, but that's just the natural thing to do for a human apparently playing the game. And so people will like naturally wear out things in the space that feels natural to them to move into.
Yeah.
Interesting. Good educational material for current day designers, I would think.
Yep.
All right, cool. Well, is that the feedback?
Yeah, I think we can stop there. And there's a couple that we've missed, but next time.
All right. Well, let's move on to the items of interest. And I think I've got the first one. And it actually is also a feedback. I just stole everything today. And so I appreciate Bob writing in to let us know about this Kickstarter for a transparent toaster Mac case. So if you've got a Mac SE or an SE30, and you would like to have a transparent rear case for it, there's a Kickstarter for you. And I went over and looked at this Kickstarter page, and this really is pretty. It's an injection molded clear case for the Apple Macintosh SE or the SE30. It lets you see all of the internals. It kind of looks like some of the prototype cases that I've seen made by Apple or other companies where they wanted you to be able to see the insides, kind of showcase the circuitry. Also, I've noticed over time in a lot of the classic Macs that I've looked at that the cases have gone horribly yellow, and wherever they had stickers, you know, say they were used in a corporate environment or something like that, and they had property of XYZ Corp stickers on there, they're nice and bright when you peel off that sticker. And so now not only do you have the old yucky yellowed kind of case look, but you've got a nice bright rectangle in the middle of that. So, and, you know, I suppose you could retrobrite it, but instead, why not get one of these transparent cases? So they've got a $15,000 U.S. goal on this Kickstarter. They've already reached $13,600 with 55 days to go. So that seems to bode well for them making it. One of their stretch goals, if they hit $27,500, they're also going to offer a clear case front panel for the Mac as well. They have a picture of what that would look like, a completely transparent classic Mac. I think it's gorgeous. What do you guys think?
Yeah, that looks very, very pleasing.
It looks really great.
You do have to make sure that your Mac is then clean inside.
Well, that will help. It will help you keep it clean because you'll see when it gets dirty.
Yeah.
It'll give you a reason to open that thing up. And I see, and I don't see any pictures of it, but they mentioned that they're going to also have colors. They're going to have like a green jade and ruby red, and so the translucent colors, I guess, similar to someone made some C64 cases like that a few years ago.
That's
like
right.
The same kind of thing. Very cool.
Yeah, I guess probably the same mold would mostly work.
But, sure.
So you could have them lined up next to your, you know, IMAX.
That C64, and it was the newer version of the C64, you know, the 64C, the more slimline version. The interesting part of that story was they found the original molds.
Right.
And then went ahead and produced cases with those additional molds. And then those molds went to a very famous Commodore aftermarket kind of third-party product manufacturer, Individual Computers, I think, is the one who got those molds. And you can still get those cases. In this situation, I don't know, I read through this Kickstarter, but it wasn't exactly clear to me. Did they have to recreate this case? Did they re-engineer this?
They did, yeah. And so they did redesign it, and somewhere here it does actually say that it is not identical. So it is not a, yes, here we go. So this is not a duplicate design, but rather our artistic interpretation. The differences between an OEM and our products are intentional. This should not be construed as a reproduction product, which I think is a bit of legalese. It's not going to be 100% the same as the original Mac. It looks pretty much the same.
And that's probably fine. And I think you were saying, Jack, the other option. So if you got deep pockets and you want to pledge $995 or more, you can get the reward package that they call the kitchen sink. It includes all the four styles, which is the ruby red, transparent rear case, sapphire blue, glow in the dark, and also just the standard transparent rear case and some other cool things along with it, signed and numbered certificate, yada, yada. So they're anticipating this will deliver toward the end of this year, November 2019.
Yep, and they're right now very, very close to their goal, and they have 55 days to go, so they're probably going to make it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not nothing, but it's not super expensive. I mean, like, if you really are going to display this somewhere, and you'd better if you buy this, what is the point?
I would say, yeah.
Just to, I mean, I think we said this, but just to clarify, it's only the back unless they hit the stretch goal. So you'd still have your, you know, yellow front on a clear back, you know, unless they make basically about twice what they're at right now.
Right.
And so for that, I do want to say that that's probably my only, the only downside I see to this is, you know, we can't see the other colors like the sapphire or the ruby. And I think those might blend a little bit better with that beige slash yellow front of the Toaster Mac. With the completely transparent one, I don't know. The contrast is a little glaring to me when I look at this profile view, the photo that they have here. And this, you know, they indicate this is the primary reward for the project. So it just the contrast of this between that beige front and the transparent back, I don't know. I'd like to see it from some other angles so that I could get a good read on it, because it's a little too contrasty for me. I'm hoping they get the front, because, you know, from where I sit, I think you'd want to replace the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could convince them to make a very yellow one so that it makes your front look white.
Kind of a reverse retro brighting experience.
Extra aged.
Right.
Wow, it looks so eggshell after I look at the back of it. Nice. All right. Well, Jack, you've got the next news item.
Right. So, and this is something that probably everyone has seen mentioned. Now, there's been a lot of talk of this lately. So Beto O'Rourke, everybody's maybe favorite candidate to talk about, if not to want to vote for. So he's been, it's been revealed. Someone is writing a book. What's the guy's name? I don't have it in front of me right now. There's a book
Joseph
coming
Mann.
Out by a guy named Joseph Mann, who is a journalist. He's writing a book about the cult of the dead cow, which is something that I remember as this hacker group that had like, they had some like stunts and things, and they had kind of an online presence in the 90s where they, I don't know, it was kind of a pseudo revolutionary thing. Like they were talking about, you know, anarchy and destroying capitalism and whatever. I don't know. I had the feeling that it was pretty young people. I mean, like my age at the time, there were probably, you know, a bunch of people, most in their 20s. I don't think they were doing like serious crimes. I think they were doing the same kind of thing that I was doing as a teenager, like, you know, making phone calls for no money and that kind of stuff. But it was not necessarily, it's not a hugely terrible thing to have been involved with. And Beto O'Rourke was involved with it in the 80s and 90s, it seems. And like he wrote some of their texts and things. And I don't know. I think this is something that some people are probably furious with rage that we now have someone who has been in, you know, has been in Congress and has been a member of some sort of what I guess they will call a domestic crime group of some kind. But I think to the extent that the Cult of the Dead Cow was or is criminal, I think it's a pretty small beans sort of thing compared to a lot of the crime in the world.
I don't think they were into anything like hugely nefarious. They did create one of the most famous early pieces of software for illicit remote control of a Windows system. And, you know, I'm not going to say what the name of the software was called because it's frankly kind of crude. But I will say, though, that it was extremely well known. And I think it kind of put CDC on the map, but they've been around pretty much forever.
Right. Like to me, it kind of, if anything, this just sort of endeared him to me a bit more. Like, I don't really know much about his politics or anything, but I very much get the sense that he is, you know, he's a guy of my generation who was into the same kind of things when he was a teenager and young man that I was. And I'm like, yeah, that's cool. It's cool to be old enough that politicians are now my peer group.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, well, that was kind of what I was thinking too. Is that you know, it's sort of, I feel like it's possible we're kind of at the beginning of that, you know, or maybe had just kind of gotten into that, where like the people who did all this, like, you know, the stuff with the computers and the phones and all that, yeah, stuff, you know, are about to be the old people running things.
Right.
It is interesting because this was a group that I had heard of then, and you know, like, it's, you know, like they were always well known. It was always a small group, you know. It's not just like anyone could claim to be part of this group, you know. It is sort of a notable thing that he was there in this universe, right. And you know, it is just cool to kind of see these, to like feel these connections or whatever. And you know, I mean, this whole story would have been much easier in a way if it had been like just some celebrity or something like that. The fact that this is somebody in politics means that you can barely mention it without everybody getting all, you know, like, oh, this is, now he's my new favorite person because of this, or, you know, he's an idiot because of this or whatever, you know.
Right.
But it is, what I think is interesting is just that this is now in mainstream news, you know, like this stuff about the Cult of the Dead Cow.
Right.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I'm with you, Jack. It's like some of these folks, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, they're the ones running the show now. So, which is just kind of interesting.
Yep.
Well, and I think, you know, there's got to be some benefit to having people who actually know computers in charge of policies.
Yeah, that seems nice. Like, we have... That now we know there is at least one congressperson who knows how computers work.
Right. And that, you know, I'm sure that it's quite possible that there are people of every, you know, political party who know computers now due to their age. But this is, you know, this is one that we have seen.
Proof.
Yeah.
So I have no possible segue from that to your next news item, Paul.
All right.
Take it away.
All right. Well, so this also came from feedback. Thanks, Bob. So there's a Hackaday article called Designing Custom LCDs to Repair Retro Computers. And essentially what this is a story of, the Hackaday write-up is relatively short, and it leads to a thread on the EEV blog that's kind of detailing this from beginning to end. But essentially what the project is looking at the TRS-80 Pocket Computer 1 or the Sharp PC-1211, which are the same machines, basically. They are calculators that have basic, you know, programming abilities and so forth. I mean, that is, you can program them in BASIC. And they have, you know, like a little LCD display that has a fairly common fault, defect that has arisen over the years, where it sort of bleeds, and you know, so the display becomes kind of non-functional, or at least, you know, it doesn't look good. And so the project is basically to try to fix these. And so the person who is working on this looks like Robert Baruch, at least that's the username on the EEV blog. But he sort of goes through, sort of talking about that he wants to try to figure out a way to replace these. He runs through getting, you know, sort of working out what the specifications, how you would order new replacement parts, and you know, talks to a couple of manufacturers. He's working with some, I think he's managed to get it down to a point where he's working with someone in particular in China to try to create, I think, you know, there's some overhead cost, and then, yeah, $300 for tooling and 10 samples, $500 for another 200 LCDs. It sounds actually super cheap, what he's managing to work out. But the story is interesting, you know, just actually going through and doing the, you know, getting the design out and sending it off for quotes and, you know, finding out what's possible and what's not possible. And it'll actually be pretty cool if it gets to the end, because there are a lot of machines that could use this repair. And even if it's not for this particular machine following that path, there are plenty of machines that use this kind of display that could use repair. So anyway, it's interesting that it's possible.
Somewhere in between now and when we have full-on, like, replicators, like in Star Trek, we seem to still be on this linear path where it's increasingly easy to fabricate things that, among other, you know, a million other fantastic uses, can be used to repair some of our classic technology in such a way, you know, that it puts it back into more of a factory state without it being an emulation or something like that. I mean, it's the real deal. You're making a new component for an old system. It's just, I see this in other contexts too, like using custom programmable circuitry like CPLDs and FPGAs and stuff like that to make replacement chips for old computers. Like you'll find some of the chips that go bad in the Commodore 64, and I'm sure this is true for some of the other systems too. I just am more plugged into the Commodore space where they make an actual replacement chip that sits in the same socket, does the same thing as the original chip did, and you can now have a new chip for your old retro computer, and it still works. And this, to me, is even some next-level stuff. You know, you're not just, like, emulating a chip or something. You're fabricating a new physical component that's going to go in your system. It's awesome. That's all I've got to say about that.
The future is coming. Yeah, I think it is interesting that we can now make new things to replace old things, and it's stuff that is, you know, there are more and more ways to make it happen, and it's cheaper and easier all the time. It's very cool.
I've got one of these too. These PC1. I don't know if the LCD has started to bleed on it. Maybe I should take it out of the bin and see if it needs a new LCD.
Yeah. I think I have, I don't have a PC1, but I must have like four or five of these PC1211s. I don't know why. There's no explanation.
These guys are really cool. A whole family of these, like there's a bigger Sharp one that I have, and some of the, I believe that Radio Shack Tandy OEM'd some of these that they sold. So it's under the Tandy label, but I think other companies like Sharp actually produced it. And years and years ago, a listener to RetroBits sent me a care package with a ton of these things, and I love playing with them. You know, anything from something like this all the way to the CC40 that I think you were just talking about that recently, weren't you, Paul? Mm-hmm. The TI-CC40, which is kind of a ginormous cousin to these guys. But they're super fun. And, you know, here's a bonus. They don't take up much room. Right? They're basic programmable. You can stick them in a desk drawer.
Yeah, that's definitely a good selling point.
Yeah.
Well, hats off to these folks.
So I'm not actually sure. I think I'm wrong, actually. The ones I have are PC 1500As. So they're similar, but they're not this thing. I think that's the one I'm thinking of is a equivalent to like a PC something else from TRS-80. PC2 or something.
I thought the 1500 was a bigger device. It has more storage capability, and it runs off some AA's. Am I wrong about that? Let me... My chair is squeaking. I bet that's coming through on the podcast. Sorry about the...
Yeah, I just go grab it.
Sorry about the haunted house sounds. Let me see here. What do we... the PC-1500 is the slightly bigger one.
Okay. Yeah, this one does look a little narrower. Don't know if this, I mean, you know, obviously the displays all have the same potential issue, but,
right.
But I wonder, you know, I wonder if it's going to turn out that a different run is going to have to be made for those, quite possibly.
I've also got the CE150, the printer and cassette interface doodad that comes with this, mm-hmm. but I think my printer is messed up in it. But the cassette interface is kind of nice because that way you can get programs on and off. And I've also got some sort of a RAM upgrade for this guy. But I'm getting way off in the weeds here. Sorry about that. We should move on. Anyway, I love these little computers, and I love that we'll be able to fix the LCDs for them. So next up, I guess I have the next news topic, which the world of computer gaming is kind of a sibling culture to retro computing with an awful lot of overlap if you looked at the Venn diagram of the right. enthusiast communities, and a kind of subculture of that computer gaming community is the computer music community, the old chiptunes. And now that is, there's lots of people who love the old chiptunes that aren't necessarily interested in retro computing or that, but they just love the old style music and they remember the music from some of the games of their youth. And this is true for a lot of the old 8-bit models. There is a huge following in the Commodore world for both the original tunes that were played on the SID sound chip and also for what they call remixes of those tunes, modern day recreations that are inspired from the music of the old computer games and that. All that preface to say that there's a concert that's going to be coming up here, and it will be performed by the Hull Philharmonic Orchestra, which is an amateur orchestra, and it's located in the hometown of Rob Hubbard. And if you're interested at all in the music on Commodore systems from back in the day, the name Rob Hubbard will ring a bell. He is a very famous composer of SID music. This effort, this concert that's going to be happening, is spearheaded by Chris Abbott. And he's a publisher and a remixer of music revolving around the Commodore 64. He and a team of folks head up c64audio.com. We'll have a link to this upcoming concert. Apparently, and this is going to be like full-on Philharmonic Orchestra. They're going to have music from the 64, from the ZX Spectrum, the Amstrad, as they say on their site, lovingly reorchestrated in the spirit of the original and performed by the Hull Philharmonic Orchestra. I would just absolutely love. Now, I'm not part of that music community per se, but have always been interested in it and love a lot of the music. And man, I would just love to be at this concert. Apparently, if this kind of takes off, they're talking about taking this show and maybe also doing these symphonies in other places. So this is coming up on the 15th of June in 2019, and tickets are now on sale. So if you're in and around that part of the world, which, you know, what I need to figure out here is exactly what part of the world this is.
So Hull is eastern edge, I think, of England.
I thought it was in the UK, but I didn't know exactly where it was located. I was trying to scroll through here real fast. Seems like that's a detail that I should have thought about before I started blabbing.
No, it's okay.
But
your thought was right anyway, so it's fine.
So it's not in Quebec, it's in the UK.
Yes.
Right. It's east of here, you know, going back to the broad geographic strokes.
To you, west of me, and not that far from me.
Yeah, you could go.
I could go.
The Hull City Hall is where this is going to be, and man, I would love to be at this concert. So I'll throw that out, and you know, if you're anywhere in that vicinity and you do go, please email us and let us know what it was like, because even if there would be a video of something like that, I don't think it would do it justice. I think you kind of got to be there.
Yep. Very cool.
All right, Paul, you've got the last news item here, something from 4 a.m.
Yep. I'll just quickly mention this because I thought this was kind of cool. So this is something that 4 a.m. has just recently released. It's for the Apple II. The issue is basically that a lot of old games, when particularly things by Broderbund and things like that, they were heavily copy protected so that you couldn't just like trade them at school or whatever. And so one of the things that they would sometimes do would be to sort of like check the machine that they're in to make sure that it doesn't have any cracking hardware in it. You know, so things that could stop it and let you like take out the memory or you know, do various things to just kind of like make it easier to crack and then copy. So one of the things that they would do is just to do like a checksum of the ROM, you know, make sure that it is unofficial like Apple II Plus ROM or something. The problem is, of course, then they came up with the Apple IIe and the Apple IIc and so forth. And this game that was made before the Apple IIe came out does not know the checksum of the Apple IIe ROM. And so it says, you know, this is not a good machine. You can't do this. I think this was mainly on Broderbund, but the response to that would be, you know, you'd boot it and the screen would clear and it would put a little M up in the corner. And, you know, that meant, I don't know what, you know, there's some problem that it was a ROM check mismatch. Another thing that often people relied on was that the 6502 has a number of opcodes that aren't defined. So, you know, they just don't have anything assigned to them. There's no specification of what they're supposed to do. But some of them actually do something, you know, just by the way the 6502 is designed, you know, like it'll do some crazy combination of things and it'll take 2 bytes to do it and that kind of stuff. So many cycles. And so some of the protection schemes actually use these undocumented opcodes to just, you know, waste time or, you know, eat bytes or whatever. And then the 6502 came out, which was in the later 2Es. And then they defined some of those opcodes to do actually useful stuff. So then, you know, again, those things that were released before the Apple, before the 2E existed, they don't know what to do with these opcodes. Now they're taking different number of cycles. They're using different number of bytes. And, you know, so that also messes up these protections. And so these actual real disks that you bought could not be booted on the newer hardware. So all of that is a preface to say that what 4AM released is basically a pre-booter for these disks. It's called Anti-M, which I think is a fantastic name. You know, that's why I mentioned that the failure mode is the M error code in the corner. But so what it does is it has a little set of games that it knows how to deal with, and it will sort of essentially boot trace them up to the point where it can disable the protection check in memory and then continue to boot. So it doesn't patch your game. It lets you boot your original still protected disk, but it gets around these checks. So and it's possible to put it on a hard drive. It's smart enough that if you didn't boot from that, you know, like if you use this program from some slot other than the normal one that the disk drive is in, then it won't prompt. It'll just go straight to the booting of the disk. It's basically a little transparent thing that lets you play your 1981 game on your 1983 machine. So, and it just the idea of this is wonderful.
It is, and it kind of makes me think that if I'd upgraded from a 2 plus to a 2E back in the day and all of a sudden my game stopped working, that I probably paid 30, 40 bucks for, I'd been kind of ticked, actually.
Yeah. You only would have had to wait till March 2019 and then everything would be fine. But yeah, the concept is really cool and it's very effective. It also will do all of the just regular 13 sector disks, I think. So those also used to require a preboot for anything except the earliest disk controllers. Anyway, so if this is relevant to you, then go get it. If it is not relevant to you, hopefully it is still interesting.
Cool.
It is interesting to me, not relevant to me, but, you know, 4AM and all of his work, he continues to not disappoint.
Yeah.
Amazing. All right. Well, I'm going to go through real quick the upcoming show roundup, and I'm just going to hit the stuff that's right around the corner. The Vintage Computer Festival Pacific Northwest in my neck of the woods is coming up next weekend. Not sure if I'm going to be able to go, actually. I've been doing a lot of traveling lately, and I might be all traveled out. But it's going to be March 23rd and 24th at the Living Computer Museum Plus Labs in Seattle, Washington. Lots of stuff going on in Australia in April. You've got the Great Australian Retro Technology Festival, or GORF, as they call it. That's in Melbourne on April 24th through the 28th. WASFest in Sydney is a new date. It's going to be May 24th, 2019, and we'll have links for these in the show notes. And QFest, Brisbane, that's also a new date, May 24th, 2019. So, way cool. If you're in Australia in April, you've got a lot of retro stuff to go do. So, get out there.
Also in May.
In May. Yes, in April and May.
They actually just switched that date. So it used to be that all three of those were on the same dates, but then it turned out that something required rescheduling it. So if you had already booked your flight to WASFest or QFest, you may have to change it.
Yeah, that would be bad. But it looks like now that's fall in Australia, right? So fall in Australia is going to be fun. Then we've got the Vintage Computer Festival East at the InfoAge Science Center in Wall, New Jersey, and that's May 3rd through the 5th, 2019. And the last one I'll talk about here right around the corner is CocoFest in Lombard, Illinois, May 4th through 5th of 2019. And as Randy Kindig pointed out recently on Floppy Days, every year we have more and more of these vintage festivals scattered all around the country and the world, and it's awesome. There's so many things you can go do if you're interested in getting together with your like-minded fellow retro computer enthusiasts. So get to as many as you can.
I should probably actually also mention one more. Just because,
yeah, go for it.
We have, since the last time we recorded, the keynote speaker for Kansas Fest has been announced. And
oh, right.
We got a press release about that, although I'm on the committee, so I knew anyway. But it's Mark Pelzarski is going to be the keynote speaker for Kansas Fest. That's July 16th to 21st. And Mark Pelzarski is basically the founder of Penguin Software. And so responsible for the Graphics Magician, responsible for some games like Transylvania and Spy's Demise and some various other things. He had a column in Soft Talk about graphics, the Soft Talk magazine. And so I'm super excited to have a chance to hear from him and talk to him. And also, he was interviewed on the Antic podcast by Kevin Savitz some time ago, a year ago or something. So maybe I'll also include a link there to that if you want to know who this is. So that's not exactly, I sort of wedged that in as a, that probably should have been a feedback, but.
Kansas Fest continues to get some, just such a great lineup of keynote speakers.
We try.
And this year's no exception. So awesome. And now, a word from our sponsor.
You're looking at a small portable computer called the IBM 5100. It's helping a lot of different people do their work more productively.
Managing real estate investments entails many difficult decisions. Do I pay it now or later? What about the landscaping? Can we afford it? What about taxes? There are many, many difficult decisions to make. It's really nice having a computer to help.
It weighs about 50 pounds. You can plug it in anywhere.
Bad weather, late deliveries, construction delays of all kinds.
How is it going to affect our schedule?
Now we can find that out fast.
The 5100 can help handle some very complex information.
Jet fuel is expensive. At Siemens Precision, we're developing a product that'll help the pilots save fuel. Flight test time is also expensive. But we do our flight tests right here in the lab on our 5100 and save time and money.
Capacity? About the same as some large computers a few years ago.
We're a mid-sized life insurance company. If we want to compete, and we do, we've got to be flexible. We've got to get answers fast. This little machine will help us do it.
The 5100 is easy to learn and simple to use.
There are countless combinations of feed we can mix. What is the most economical for any particular herd? That's what I'm figuring out now.
The cost of the 5100 is reasonable.
Paper, ink, size, weight, overhead, and don't forget the shipping cost. Estimating a printing job is not so easy. Our estimators handle 50% more work since we got the 5100.
We do it faster and a lot more accurately, and our customers really love it.
The IBM 5100. It's bringing the advantages of the computer to more and more people. IBM, helping put information to work for people.
And we're back, and now I have to talk about what everybody wants to buy for me. Wait, is that? No, it's just a gift idea. I mean, it doesn't have to be for, no, it should be for me. this is called a 1977 pillow, And I admit, I even stole this gift idea from our bullet point list of gift ideas that we keep in the show notes. I'm stealing everything this time around. I should mention that the earlier news story that I talked about, the 8-Bit Symphony, was emailed to us by Tony. So thank you, Tony. I don't want to just, you know, plagiarize stuff without attribution. But this pillow is cool. It's a little Apple II pillow. And it looks, you know, just like the Apple II, which was the very first microcomputer that I ever played with, except it's a pillow, so you can hug it. I couldn't hug the Apple II, but you can hug this one. And if you look at the page for this, the You Ought to Buy It page, they've even got a little GIF where they've got it spinning around. You can see it from all the angles. And then you've got comments about how people love it and it's great quality, and they sit and watch TV and they hug their Apple II pillow. So you should get this pillow, I think.
It's amazing.
And it's a fairly big size too. I mean, you can tell from this GIF, it's not like one of these little tiny pillows.
It's a good size pillow. And I want to say, spoiler alert, if you click on the next button when you're looking at this page, there are more Apple products in pillow forms from later years.
That's right. So you can get a 1984 Exciting. Mac.
Yep.
So if you want, what other ones are there?
There's a 1984 Mac. There is a 1998 iMac, I think it was. And there's a 2001 pillow, which is an iPod. And there's a 2007, which is an iPhone.
If you keep going a couple more, you can get to the spinning wheel of death pillow.
The iMac looks so cuddly. I want to cuddle with this iMac. Yeah.
They're all pretty cool. And, you know, if you don't want to hug it, you can also punch it, I think.
That's an interesting thought. Another thing that you can't do with your actual computer.
Once.
I guess you can if you don't mind the consequences, right? Yeah, that's a funny... I was a smart aleck when I was a kid, and I was in driver training. And so I asked my driver training instructor, hey, can I go straight from drive to reverse? And that's the same response I got. My driver training instructor said yes, once. So I also want to point out that this is ultra soft, 100% vegan, fine grain plush. Just in case that's important to you. Now, I don't know what they mean when they say 3D design. I mean, it seems to me like that if a pillow was only 2D or maybe 1D, that it would be, you know, kind of hard, kind of like sleeping on a piece of paper. So I'm glad.
A pillow that is just a single point, the one-dimensional pillow. Okay.
And, you know, the worst thing is I can never find it. I look all around for it. It's just gone. But, yes, they are in 3D, and they're rather good size, and they're really cute. So that is my stolen Excellent. Gift idea.
I like it a lot. They actually have a ton of cool products, this company. I approve.
And actually, I can even reveal that the way I found out about it is that 4AM got one and tweeted a picture of it. So.
Oh, nice. The 4AM trend continues. Again, with the not disappointing. Perfect.
What is it with all this not disappointing?
Yeah. This is too much positive. We need some negative.
Setting the bar too high here. We're going to start expecting things.
So now we can talk about buying other things on eBay. And I've just got one thing, but it's a really heavy thing. So it is this Burroughs 5-disc pack. And it's one of these, if you've ever seen these old removable disc packs, I've got a bunch of these from my PDP-11, but they're only a single disc. This sucker is 5 of these 14-inch magnetic disc platters. So I imagine you could really do your curl exercises with this guy. And it looked so neat. And the thing that I like about it is with the DEC disc packs that I have, the 10 megabyte, you know, single 14-inch, they're not translucent. you can't see the mechanism on the inside, but with this one, you can. So not only is it a highly effective paperweight, your paper is going nowhere if this sucker is on top of them, but it is very cool to look at from the side. So this is my submission. It's a buy it now for $55 with shipping of $43, which actually the shipping almost seems low to me, given what this thing, dimensions of it and what it must weigh. So what do you guys think of this?
Well, I see that on the side of it, there's a little sticker. It says, you know, this disk pack has been tested and found to be acceptable. The error location identified below should not be used for data storage. And there's a little table where you can put, you know, where all the errors are that you're not supposed to write to. And it's unmarked. So apparently it is fully error-free.
coming out of the factory, this thing had no defects, which was awesome. We cannot guarantee that is still the case. So in case you happen to have a mammoth disk drive that takes one of these suckers, I want to point out that the auction says it is being sold as a collectible in as-is condition. And they indicate, use the pictures provided to judge its cosmetic condition. I'm not sure what else I would use to judge its cosmetic condition, maybe a description. But as I look at it, it's in pretty good cosmetic condition.
Yeah.
From all the sides of it. I mean, it's got some sticker residue on one spot, you know, some of the things you would... Oh, and I should also point out that the translucent case is kind of in that... What color would you call this? Kind of a...
Smoke, maybe?
A smoke color. That... Excellent. Well done. So that's my pick. Paul, it looks like you got a couple picks.
Yeah. Jack, you want any of these?
No, wait. I have a late entry. I have a pick. I have a thing, guys. I found something. I'm going to paste it in here. You guys can see it.
Go for it.
I know that some of you guys have used things like the Newton and stuff. I've never actually had a Newton. I've never even touched a Newton. I've been in the same room as a Newton. That's about it. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that Apple came out after the first Newton was this E-Mate, this little folding thing. And I always thought this thing was really cool looking because it ran the Newton OS, had the pen interface and everything, and had what looks like a decent, reasonable keyboard all in one folding little thing. And there's one of these on eBay right now, and the current bid is only $10. And that to me seems insanely cheap. It makes me wonder what is wrong because the photo shows pictures of this thing working. And I don't know. What do you say, Paul? This seems too cheap, doesn't it?
I think it's it was just started at something very low and hasn't been there very long.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, they're almost 6 days to go, but still, it's just like, wow, damn.
Yeah. So if nobody hears about this, so then the E-Mate is really pretty cool. It it has the same sort of clamshell shape as the iBook did. Those early ones. But yeah, no, it has an original pen. It has, you know, we can see that it works well enough that you can read the screen. You know, it starts up well enough to do the calibration. And it comes with all the manuals. So the only thing that I think it lacks is the actual external box. But it looks like all the manuals are there. The CD is there, the cables and everything. So another thing that these things often have as a problem is that the flip-up top can sort of lose its, I don't know what it is, but it's, you know, whatever it is that keeps it upright, so it'll just flop back. But this isn't doing that.
Right. Cool.
So.
Well, maybe you should just edit this whole thing out, Paul, so I can buy it. Although, on the other hand, it says may not ship to Sweden, so.
Oh, no.
I may be screwed anyway. Anyway, I'm gonna watch this. I might try and buy this thing.
Okay.
Don't you have one or more of these, Paul? I thought I remembered you talking about them in the past.
Yeah. I haven't done too much with. I think I have two. One of the ones that I got had a. It was I probably for, you know they're sort of school machines, you know, and so this particular one was used in a school and had a sort of instrumentation connections, and I used it to test the voltages on an Apple II Plus motherboard. So that's like the one thing I've done is like I used it as a little like voltage tester, which is pretty cool.
Wow, that is cool. How did you do that again?
Well, there was a I think what is the name of the company, Verniers or something like that, makes a bunch of these sort of like educational instrumentation things. You know, so there was a box, a serial box that you connect to it, and then you connect these little probes to it, and then I connected the probes to the various places on the 2 plus motherboard to see if I could figure out like where the power was, where the power was going through and where it wasn't. So yeah. Anyway, the other thing that actually the Newtons, at least the later Newtons and this guy too, can take a wireless card. So
right.
If you have a sufficiently dumb wireless network, you can connect to it. I think at this point you need to like set up a specific like vintage wireless network for it to
right.
communicate. But
so an 802.11b network, would that be
probably?
Is that what it uses?
Like that was the first. That's the first one that was like built into the first in the early iMacs and stuff. Uh-huh. Like the first Wi-Fi that Apple was pushing a lot was 802.11b. So. That's probably what this is. Anyway, that's what I found. I was pretty happy to find that.
Nice.
Nice.
And then I'm sure I won't buy it, but it looks cool.
It does. I love the look of these.
Yeah, this like semi-transparent green. It's just so lizardy and weird and cool. I'm into it.
And they're they're supposed to be pretty rugged because there are four kids. They do have batteries in them. Well, they don't. At least you can get them with like rechargeable batteries in them, which you will want to take out. Mm-hmm. But I mean, at least at this point, it seems like it is not corroded away to the point where it doesn't start. So,
right, it's working. So,
well, what do you have, Paul?
All right,
looks like you got a couple things.
Yes, I have a couple.
I love this first one. go ahead and mention it, and then I have a snarky comment.
Okay.
I mean, Carrington's not here, and somebody's got to do it.
All right. This is an IBM Microsoft Adventure. So this is back in the, I guess they did do Flight Simulator for a long time, so maybe that was Microsoft. Anyway, it's in an IBM package, total IBM, like, little gray folder, very uninteresting looking thing, until you open it up and you see, like, the big dragon on the cover of the manual. So it's early, Microsoft Adventure 1.0, and I think it is actually relatively collectible. Apparently, the bidders think so because it's already been bid up to $102.50. But and there's still 6 days to go. So, but what are your snarky comments, Earl?
Oh, I only have one, which is nothing says fun like one of these IBM binders.
Yes.
Just if you look at this, I mean, I would not think this is a game. But like you say, Paul, when you open it up and see the nice little graphic on the inside, then it becomes clear that, okay, this has the potential to be fun.
And then when you boot it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it might still be fun. But anyway, yeah, all of these, I mean, the IBM binder, they had a style, right? I mean, if you look at any of the software from this era, very consistent kind of branding and style. And it did say business, and it didn't say fun.
Yeah.
So just wanted to point that out. But yeah, this probably is a collectible item. I mean, people who bid on these kind of things tend to, I think, know what they're doing. So mm-hmm. I would say the $100 price tag reflects that.
It actually sort of reminds me a little bit of the Radio Shack stuff too, had that same property that it was like, this is all boring leather bound books. Mm-hmm. Nothing fun is happening here. Okay, so the next thing I have, I sort of liked the listing. It is called, the listing says new old computer. And then underneath it says in Cyrillic, computer. CCCP, but USSR or whatever. The description says old computer. But so what it is it is known as the KR03. It is an 8080 machine, Electronica RK03, RKO3. That's not what that is. I said, and I wrote in my notes that that's what it is, but I can read the box and that's not what it is. But I believe that what it is a sort of like a kit computer. Like you got sort of the components and put it together, and this may have been preassembled, but it's pretty basic. But it's covered in Cyrillic, so that's also kind of interesting. It's currently in Alden, Illinois. So that's one thing that differentiates this computer that's covered in Cyrillic from some of the others that we have seen, is that it's not being shipped from, you know, from anywhere overseas from me.
But, right.
Clearly the seller knows next to nothing about this thing. but yeah, so it does, you know, who knows if it works. It seems to have a cassette and a manual and stuff, which I think is probably relatively rare. I mean, like if you happened to be looking for one of these radio constructor radio computer, I don't know, whatever it is. I can't quite. I'm not very good reading Cyrillic, but this looks like a pretty good one, actually.
Yeah, it looks very nice. Like it has a nice sort of like everything seems very sort of clean and unstained. It's probably been in that box the whole time.
Yeah.
I wonder what it has, like, what does it connect to? Does it have a video out? Or like, there are no pictures. All you see is the top of it. There's no sort of idea, like, how do you interface with this? Besides, you can, obviously you can type away at it, but like, what are you going to see? What is this going to drive?
Yeah, there is, I know I saw some photos of the back of one of these. On the back, there's going to be a video out. This is very irritating. I'm pretty sure that Foon on Twitter had posted about this at some point. Here we go.
Okay.
I will put the link in the show notes so we can all look at it. But then I should probably move on to the next one. The one that Foon had linked to is a much more beat up case, but clearly the same thing. And on the back, it has something on the left that says video and then mag. I don't know what that is. So there's a couple of connectors in the back.
Okay. But, cool.
Yeah. Let me move on to the next thing, which is, I feel like I might have linked to these before, but this is a ORA Redguard data protection. I think these are very cool. They are, I don't quite know how they work, but you plug them into your, they're things that you plug your phone into. You know, they're little, you know, phone connector things that will protect your computer transfers from, like, your parents picking up the phone.
Mm-hmm.
As you can see from the graphic,
yeah.
On the front of this, where the person has done a face plant on the keyboard because mom has decided to make a call right in the middle of me downloading, you know, the new Doom.
Yeah. And then you get the old communication line failure.
Yep.
I hate it when that happens.
Man.
Yeah, it says also functions as a privacy device to keep phone conversations private. So somehow it must be detecting like a voltage drop or something that tells you that one of the extensions is picked up, and then it doesn't let you pick up your extension. Must be what's happening. But anyway, that's a thing that nobody needs anymore. Because right. First of all, we don't use modems, and second of all, what is privacy?
Right. Yeah, data protection. Who needs that? No, I've heard dial-ups coming back, though. So.
Okay.
This fiber thing is a fad.
The next one, I feel like I have actually mentioned this before. Maybe this, I wonder if it's in fact the same auction, but I thought it was kind of cute. So this is a vintage Osborne car adapter. So it plugs into the, like, you know, what we used to call the cigarette lighter spot, mm-hmm. on the car, and then you can plug it into your Osborne and, you know, compute on the go.
Finally.
Yeah. It does say that it's not working. I don't know how it was tested exactly, but if it was, I mean, like, if it was stuck into the car and then, you know, it didn't power anything through the wire, then it may well not be working. And at that point, you know, you could probably just build your own. But
it's kind of neat that it's Osborne branded, but, you know, I'm imagining it's just like your standard power inverter.
Right. Sure. System.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, like, you might well be able to get one at Home Depot or something, but
this is probably something for the Osborne completist who wants to have every bit of kit they ever had.
Yep. I don't know. There's something, I don't understand why I like that logo, but I do kind of like that logo.
Yeah, the Osborne logo is neat. So I'm just wondering, you know, that you can't text now while you drive, right? But what about this? I mean, the police officer pulls up beside you, and you've got an Osborne in the passenger seat. You're kind of one-handing
trying to, like,
it.
Move the window off to the right so you can see the second half of the screen. Very cool. Next one I just thought was sort of interesting is a Maxell CP10, which is a cassette tape specifically designed to be too short to put anything but a computer program on. It's a 10-minute cassette tape. So, it's nice and wrapped. Looks pretty futuristic.
I wonder what the quality was of it, because, you know, one of the things that they would warn was if you were using a 30-minute or a 60-minute cassette, that was fine. But if you got above those, then the tape was, what, more thin or something like that and could break and lose all your programs. And so I wonder if this had any advantage other than just being cheaper. Like, I wonder if it's a little bit better quality for the repetitive writing over that you would do with a computer tape.
Yeah, I wouldn't hope. It says on the back that it utilizes a high-output tape design, but, I mean, that may not mean anything. It also has a short leader, so you can start reading and writing immediately. So that's possibly good. Don't end up, like, trying to write your computer program to a bunch of, like, transparent plastic. Right. It is only 5 minutes per side. It is 10 minutes total, which is, I guess, that was the standard way they did. You know, a 60-minute tape was 30 minutes on each side, but...
Yeah. But, like, I remember a lot of the software that I had on cassette for my Atari 400 back in the day, like, the load time was seldom less than 5 minutes. Like, you'd pop in a tape, and it'd be playing at, like, normal tape playback speed, and it would take 15 minutes to load sometimes. So, I don't know. It seems like it'd be very small programs that would even be storable on this. I don't know.
Interesting. It has to be, like, for VIC-20 programs. Something. 5K of RAM.
Right. Let's see. So the penultimate one I had was a Quazon QuickLink 300, which is a home video terminal. I just think it kind of looks neat, and this is a very complete set. It is just a terminal. So I think you plug it into your TV. It has a like a membrane keyboard, you know, black and silver and red and blue. And, you know, you use it. It's actually kind of like the telecomputer I was talking about before, you know, the IXO thing. I mean, it's you just sort of connect it to your phone, you connect it to your TV, you call TimeNet or CompuServe or Dow Jones or whatever. And
cool. So it had a built-in 300 baud modem, and it would just do its thing.
Yeah. But it's actually, I think, kind of what I like about this more than anything is the box, you know, I mean, like the box and the manuals, it's like, it's all there. Yeah. Not super cheap, I guess. It's a $60 buy it now, but, so it'll probably still be there because it's relatively expensive. You have to really like that box.
Right. And interesting, having just mentioned the Atari 400, to see that someone did not learn the error of that keyboard design
right.
in making another device. 5+ years later.
I'm sure it was cheaper. Oops.
Very yeah. true.
Yep.
Probably also equally spill resistant, though.
Yeah, true. Pour your Coke all over that thing. It's fine.
So, you know, here's an interesting thing. I'm looking at the back of this box. And so the Source, CompuServe, you know, use those. I remember from back in the day, all of the things like the modems and the telecom software and all, they all talked about this Dow Jones news retrieval service. But I never knew anybody who had that service. And if I don't know if I'm remembering this right, but it seems like it was prohibitively expensive. They all touted it, but I don't know anybody who ever used it. Did you guys ever use it?
No.
Oh, no. No. I mean,
you're probably right. It probably was something super expensive.
Like a business kind of thing. Right?
Yeah.
Like you'd only want it if you had a, okay.
Yep. Yeah. When I had a job 20 years ago where, I was working for a company making finance software, and we had a Bloomberg terminal that we could look at. And there's, like, they had hardware terminals, and they also had like a software package that you'd run on a Mac or a PC, I guess. And it was like, it was essentially a terminal emulator, but you would log in and you have a very sort of kind of DOS looking interface, just all sort of text. And that was a subscription you had to pay to get on this, which you got at that point, you got through the internet. I think you didn't have to dial in, but yeah, it was something you had to pay through the nose for that subscription.
Mm.
And we only had it because we were a finance software company. And like the guy who was the CEO, he knew how to use it because he had this, that was his background, was doing finance stuff. So he was like, he would get in there and he was very adept at the keyboard, jumping around and doing stuff. And that's the way he preferred actually to read financial news, was that compared to doing anything on the web. But yeah, it costs a lot. It's probably the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Let's see. And the last one I have is a CP plus telecoupler. Part of the reason I sort of put this in here is just because it isn't going for very much. It is a, well, I guess, I don't know, depending on what you think, you're never going to use it, I'm sure, but it is a $20 starting bid. But so,
are you completely ignoring my earlier comment about dial-up? It's coming back, sir. I'm just telling you.
So this particular auction does not make it very clear what this thing actually is. It's like this little bar that has a phone connector on it. But sort of looking around at other instances of the telecoupler, what it basically is, it's essentially a way to convert like a regular, what is RJ11 or whatever that is, the phone connector, to a regular audio coupler that you put on a phone, like in a hotel where you don't have access to the jack. Right? Mm. So if you are traveling or somewhere that you can't like actually unplug the phone and plug your own thing in, this is a thing that you can secure to almost any phone, and sort of emulate what you would have gotten by plugging it directly in.
So it's an acoustic coupler, but maybe a bit more flexibility. It's not designed for exactly the kind of old school rounded cup phone that you would sit in a solid acoustic coupler.
Right, exactly.
Kind of the idea.
Yeah.
You kind of strap this onto any phone a bit because it's a little bit adjustable somewhat.
Yeah. And instead of ending in a like RS-232 or something, it ends in a like a phone connector.
Right.
So yeah. Anyway, another one of these objects that, apart from the coming return of dial-up, is going to be kind of hard to find a use for. But I have some kind of similar object. It's not, this one is slightly more flexible. The one I have actually is a device that you're supposed to like take the phone and unscrew it, like you're in the hotel or whatever, and you unscrew like the part where the microphone is, and then you put some object in it. But it was solving the same problem. Like you're traveling and you need to connect, and so for whatever reason you don't have access to the relevant plugs. Anyway, that's it. That's all the weird stuff I had collected.
Very nice entries. Lots of stuff to buy.
Excellent.
Well, I guess that takes us to the parting shots. So, Jack, why don't you go first?
Yeah, so I went to the Retro Gathering in Västerås, Sweden. Was that about a month ago? 3-4 weeks ago, something like that. And it's a thing that's a twice-a-year event that they have in the fall. Sometime they have an event focused on video games. And in February they have one focused on more sort of home computers, old computers, that kind of thing. And so I've been to the one in the fall a couple times before. This is my first time going to the vintage computer edition. And I have to say, it was not as much going on as I kind of hoped. Like there's people selling things. I bought one of those Zonix double-ended Atari 2600 cartridges, like a game cartridge. And I picked up, there was a freebie box where people were just like putting things they wanted to give away and anybody could take. And I picked up in there two books that came with the, what was it called? There's this thing called Infocom's Greatest Hits that I think came out in the early 90s that was a collection of a bunch of their games. And that came with one book that was the manual for all the games and one book that was the hint books for all those games. And just those two books were lying in there. I took those. Cool. But otherwise, there were a few people selling things, a few people showing some interesting little computer, but not really much. And there were no presentations. It wasn't really much of an, there weren't many activities. Let's put it that way. In one room, there was kind of one big ring of a bunch of 70s and 80s computers set up, usually with a couple games that you could switch between. Most of them were things I was familiar with. There are a couple things that were unfamiliar, but those were really not being used either. So it's like, I don't know if they were even necessarily working all of it. I don't know. It was for me, since it was a 1 hour drive away, it was worth going to. But like, I think the fall ones, even though they're focused more on games, I think they're more interesting even for computer hobbyists, just because there are more people and there are some activities and some discussions and some things being shown in a different way. So,
all right.
Anyway, don't want to bag on Retro Gathering too much. I enjoyed myself. I could have enjoyed myself more. I had hoped.
Well, perhaps the way we could look at this is you are encouraging people to go, because if everybody goes, it'll be fun.
That's right. If everybody just goes, it'll be fun.
Yeah, and maybe it'll build up over time.
Yep. So that's me. That's what I've been doing.
What you got, Paul?
Well, let's see. So I guess the note I put in here, I guess there's some connection. I recently, when was this? Wednesday or something? Doesn't matter. You're hearing this in the distant future anyway. But went to see the Doctor Who episode Legopolis in the theater. It was like a big event. They played this in the theater. It's basically the last of the Tom Baker episodes, to those who know what this means. And so it was, you know, sort of cut together as a movie, and then they had like a little interview and some stuff at the end, which it ultimately was. You know, the idea was that it was going to be kind of like an interview about something that had to do with the episode. The episode itself, large parts of it took place near a big radio telescope that was modeled on the radio telescope at the Jodrell Bank Radio Observatory, and so in Britain. And so the documentary was very weird, because it was basically Tegan and Nyssa, the people who played those companions, were at the radio telescope talking to somebody there about like stuff that had to do with the radio telescope. So essentially the connection to the episode was just like, it would have been cool if we could have shot it here and then talked about stuff that had to do with like what the radio telescope did that didn't even actually appear in the show. But it did have some people that were in the show. But so one thing that was mentioned that I thought was kind of cool, though, is that one of the things that radio observatory did was they, when the Soviet Union launched a probe to the moon, this radio telescope pointed its you know, telescopic eye at the moon, and then, you know, sort of like intercepted all the signals. And somebody realized that at some point, you know, listening to the signals, that it kind of sounded like a fax machine. And at least the way the lore goes, they essentially got a fax machine from the Daily Express and ran the signal through it and then got a picture of the moon that the Soviets took.
Wow. Talk about MacGyvering something.
Yeah. So I thought that was, you know, that was at least as cool a thing as the whatever that was going on in the interview. But yeah, and actually also one other thing that was sort of interesting was that figuring into that episode itself at some point was bubble memory. So I think, you know, way back a long time ago at the beginning of this episode, we were talking about the bubble memory and the telebubble terminal, and, you know, the fact that it is non-volatile. In fact, I think they even said it was non-volatile, like verbatim in the episode, you know, like it was a interesting thing because they could then take this board with the memory on it and, you know, take it somewhere else so they could use this to recreate some program. So.
Oh, nice.
So slightly accurate, but anyway. So what are your closing thoughts, Earl?
Not much, other than I just got to check to see what's going on with family and schedule to see if I can make it up to Seattle next weekend for the VCF. And also, since we talked about those LCDs, I think after we're done here, I'm probably going to pull out my PC 1500 from the storage bin and make sure the LCD is still happy in there. I haven't played with that in a long time, and it's actually kind of one of the coolest of the old handheld basic computer/calculators that I've got. So aside from that, I think that's it.
Yeah, I just when I was looking at my, I was trying to remember the name of that IXO telecomputer, and so I pulled, I knew what drawer it was in, so I took it out to look and see, so I could remember, and I came across also my Casio FX730P, and have, and I thought, and I did the thing that I was supposed to have done a long time ago, which is take the batteries out, so it now has, the batteries were dead, and they are now out.
Very good. Yeah, as you know, we have to mention Kevin Savitz in every episode. We also probably should do our public service announcement every time that if you've got retro computers that have like an internal rechargeable battery, or if you've got some AA's sticking around, in those old computers, or even sometimes, the old, what do you call them, the old circular battery kind of things, those are all potential hazards. They might eat your circuit boards. So they leak, they cause havoc. Get them out of there. Get those batteries out, as they say.
You got to come up with a catchy slogan for get those batteries out.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
Think about that for next
time. Don't copy that floppy, but, about batteries.
But, right. My daughter's going into marketing. I'll see if she can't cut me a catchphrase for that.
Awesome.
And that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com, as if by magic. You can discuss the show in the forums, and you can discuss lots of other vintage stuff in the forums at www.vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can find RCR on Twitter. We're at RCR Podcast. We've got a Facebook group, increasingly active, lots of great posts there, so find us over on Facebook. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We're a member of the Throwback Network. We'll keep saying that for a while. It's at throwbackreviews.com. It's changed a bit, but we're over there, and you can find a link in the show notes. Please write a review for us on iTunes, because this might or might not help other people find the show. We have no way of knowing whether that's true or not, but we think it is, so just do it. And until next time,
Retro Compute.